Before we jump into today's episode, we've got a free resource you won't want to miss. It's called The Robot Race: Could AI Ever Replace Humanity? A thought-provoking ebook exploring the rise of artificial intelligence, what it means to be human, and how Christians can think biblically in this new tech age. If you've ever asked, can machines become conscious? Or does AI challenge our faith? This is for you. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast. Before we jump into today's episode, we've got a free resource you won't want to miss. It's called The Robot Race: Could AI Ever Replace Humanity? A thought-provoking ebook exploring the rise of artificial intelligence, what it means to be human, and how Christians can think biblically in this new tech age. If you've ever asked, can machines become conscious? Or does AI challenge our faith? This is for you. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Good afternoon. Welcome along to Unbelievable. I'm Justin Briley. This is the show that brings Christians and non-Christians together every Saturday afternoon here on Premier Christian Radio, part of Faith Explored. And a really interesting discussion for you today on conversion and deconversion. More on that in a moment's time. Perhaps, though, if you're a regular listener of the show, you'll not be surprised to know that this is a pre-recorded version of today's programme, because I am, of course, actually at Westminster Central Hall on Saturday. Unbelievable, the conference finally taking place today, and we're going to be hearing some of the feedback to that, some of the sessions in future editions of Unbelievable, as well as letting you know how you can get hold of a DVD CD of the conference this year. So look out for that in future editions of the programme. But if you want to find out more about the programme, why not visit the all-new brand spanking website for Premier Christian Radio and the Unbelievable webpage thereof. That's at premier.org.uk/Unbelievable. So the website web page address remains the same, but it is a completely new looking web page. So if you haven't visited in a while, do go there, check out some of the recent shows, some of the new features that we're adding there. It is exciting. So premier.org.uk/Unbelievable. That is unveiled literally this weekend as I speak. Okay, what's happening on today's show? Let me introduce you to today's guests. You're unbelievable. We're talking about conversion and deconversion. The atheist turned theologian and the Christian turned atheist. Well, Guillaume Bignon is a French theologian, but he was an atheist until a few years ago. A series of personal events led him on an intellectual journey to investigate Christianity, and he did become a Christian. We'll be hearing his story today, and he'll be interacting with Wade Padgett, who has a story himself of going in the opposite direction from Christian belief to atheism. Well, today they're going to be discussing their respective stories and what part experience and evidence play in making someone decide for or against faith. Should be another cracking edition of the programme today. So a very warm welcome to you both, gentlemen. First of all, thank you for joining me here in the studio, Wade. Thank you for coming in today.
Thanks very much for having me.
You've come all the way from the States. I'd like to think just for my show, but you're over here on a bit of a sightseeing tour, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
Great to have you here. We'll come to you in a moment's time to meet you properly. Guillaume Bignon, am I pronouncing this correctly, Guillaume?
Yeah, that's actually pretty impressive.
Oh, there you go. Those GCSE French lessons didn't go to waste, you see. you're joining us via Skype today from New York, where you are currently resident. But of course, your story starts in France, doesn't it, Guillaume?
That's very true. I've been only here for the last few years, and I'm very much French, as my accent will very easily betray. So I was born in France.
Well, you've got very good English, I must say, Guillaume. But tell us what happened to you, because until several years ago, you were actually an atheist, weren't you? Do you want to tell us what happened?
Yes. So the conversion story has a lot of different points, and it's very hard to make it justice in a small condensed account, but I'll try very hard to make it brief and to hit the various important steps that happened to me. So I grew up very much in France. I was born in the suburb of Paris and grew up there with a very loving family. My father was a mathematician by training, and he was a computer scientist by vocation. And my mother was a stay-at-home mom and very, very dedicated to the education of her children. So I had a very favorable environment growing up. And we were nominally Roman Catholic, so we would regularly go to Mass. But in France, I mean, this was more of a nominal belief. It was more born out of tradition or maybe superstition than really a genuine living faith that Jesus was who he claimed to be. And I went through the motions for years, and then as soon as I was old enough to tell my parents that I didn't believe any of this, then I just stopped going to Mass. And my life as an atheist was really not different at all than it had been before. It's just that there was no pretense anymore. And I was essentially pursuing my own pleasure and happiness in life. So on various grounds, well, because of that favorable environment with at home and my mom's devotion to our education, I did very well in school. And so I went on to study math, physics, and engineering science in college, and ended up graduating from a fairly prestigious engineering school in France that landed me a job as a computer scientist. And on the personal side, I tried to accomplish my own fame and pleasure by engaging in music. So I was playing the keyboard in a rock band, and I ended up growing up to be 6 feet four and jumping 3 feet high. So I was scouted by my brother's volleyball team, and I ended up playing in National League. So I traveled all the weekends throughout the country to play the games of volleyball.
This obviously gives you the story of someone who's very happy with their life in many ways.
I'll definitely pursuing that happiness pretty ferociously. And I mean, these things, I was very grateful and very happy with the way it was starting to turn out. Another very important part of French atheistic ideals, at my age at least, was also feminine conquests, at which I was starting to have enough success to satisfy the raunchy standards of the volleyball locker room. So all in all, I was essentially pursuing my pleasure on all those fronts and doing a pretty good job at it.
So tell us what happened, because I understand part of your journey involved, again, pursuing a female interest, but this person turned out to be a Christian.
Yeah, that's right. So I was in this very secular culture. The chances of me ever hearing the gospel, let alone believing it, were extremely slim. And it happened in a funny way, where I was on vacation in the Caribbean with my brother to enjoy the beach and play a bit of beach volleyball and just enjoy our time in St. Martin in the Caribbean. And we decided out of the blue one day to come back from the beach by hitchhiking. And it was the very first time in my life, and I never did it since. So it was really a random occurrence. We decided to hitchhike our way back home. And there's a car of tourists that stopped. They were actually not stopping to pick us up, but they were lost on their way from the airport to the hotel, and they were asking for direction. And it so happens that the hotel they were going to was right next door to the house we were trying to get back to.
Okay.
So by these very improbable circumstances, they just accepted to pick us up. And that they were two tourists from the United States. One from New York, one was from Miami. And they were attractive enough that the radar went up immediately. And we started to pursue them. And I ended up dating the one who was from New York. And very soon enough, I was informed that she was a believing Christian, which to me was an intellectual suicide by my own standards. But I figured she's attractive enough. I'm going to pursue this. And so she flew back to New York and I flew back to France. And here we were in a problematic long distance relationship where I basically needed to disabuse her of her silly Christian beliefs so that we could be together and happy. And so this is the point at which I finally had to ask myself the question, well, how am I going to go about this? If I'm going to be criticizing Christianity, I first needed to know what Christianity claimed. And so I picked up a Bible and I started to read about Jesus. I figured this is a good place to start.
Yeah, fair enough.
So I realized that my atheism wasn't necessarily born out of a strong reason, too. It's just that culturally speaking, everyone around me, especially smart people around me, just didn't believe in God, and we took it for granted. We didn't spend much time worrying about this. So for the first time, I was asking the questions, well, could any of this be true? And the account of Jesus I read was pretty impressive. I was impressed by the authority that this man had. I didn't have much place in my atheistic worldview for his claims of supernatural and miracles and God, but just the sheer way of how he navigated in conversation kind of caught my attention. And I figured, look, I'm a scientist. There's also one additional experiment I can carry out to test my investigation. So if God exists, then he's probably looking at my project right now and he's interested in what's going on. So let me just pray and ask him, look, if you're real, why don't you go ahead and reveal yourself to me? I'm open. Well, I wasn't really, but I figured I shouldn't stop God if he existed. So
it's interesting to hear that, in as much as I don't know if you have listened to some episodes of this show in the past, Guillaume, but I once did something called the Atheist Prayer Experiment about a year and a half ago. Essentially encouraging atheists to do exactly what you did. Now, the results were kind of mixed, and the vast majority said they don't think they felt anything, or had they dropped out early, or couldn't keep it up, you know, for the amount of time that we were trying to run it. But I mean, did you feel anything at the time you prayed, or would you say there was a kind of a delayed response at some level?
Oh, I didn't feel anything on that very moment. No, that was clearly a delayed response, but the events that followed make me confident that that prayer wasn't lost on everybody. Mm. So very shortly after I prayed that prayer, one thing happened is that given my investigation into Christianity, I was nowhere near ready to accept any of those claims, and I couldn't even visit a church even if I wanted, because volleyball games kept me out on volleyball courts every Sunday and
I see.
Traveling the country every weekend. So that couldn't happen. Well, that barrier didn't last for long, because a couple of weeks after I prayed that prayer, completely out of the blue, my shoulder for the spiking arm just started to fail me. It was inflamed and very painful after 10 minutes into every volleyball practice. So I just couldn't play. The doctor couldn't find anything wrong. The physical therapist's best efforts didn't help anything. And I was basically told, look, you just need to rest your shoulder and you can't play volleyball. Volleyball for a couple of weeks. Here I was off of volleyball courts for a couple of weeks, and I figured, well, since I've been investigating this Christianity thing, maybe I'm going to go and visit one of those churches to see what those Christians do when they get together. So I got the address of an evangelical church in Paris, and I drove there by myself on that Sunday morning, and I was extremely awkward. It was very strange, because the intellectual respect that there is for the belief that God exists is so low, at least I perceived it this way, and all my friends agreed, that my sheer presence in a building, a church, would have been perceived as shameful by anyone who could see me. So I was very oppressed by that awkwardness when I walked into that church. And the way I describe it that gets a few laughs is that I really went there like you would go to the zoo in order to see some weird exotic animals that you've heard about or that you've read in books but you've never seen in real life. And so I went there to check out those weird animals, and I don't remember a thing that the preacher said on that day, but I was very, very uncomfortable. And so as soon as he finished his sermon, I figured I've seen enough. I need to escape and avoid making eye contact with any of these weirdos so that they wouldn't introduce themselves. And so I jumped on my feet, ran to the back of the church, and I literally had 1 foot out the door when I got a strong blast of chills in my stomach, rushing all the way in my chest and grabbing me by the throat and stopping me on the doorstep. And I was very caught by this, and I heard myself thinking, this is ridiculous. I have to figure this out. And so I stopped, turned around, I put my foot down, closed the door in front of me, and I walked back all the way straight up to the head pastor, and I introduced myself. And I said, so you believe in God, huh? He said, yes. I said, well, how does that work out? And he said, we can talk about it. And so when everyone was gone, he took me to his office and we discussed about it for hours. And here was a man who was clearly not emotionally driven by some weird sense of having to compensate for something. He was intelligent. He knew what he was talking about. He was educated, rational, and he believed that God exists and that Jesus was raised from the dead. And I just couldn't fathom it. So for a number of months after that, I would come back to see him and we would talk and I would bombard him with questions and he would provide reasonable biblical answers to explain me his worldview. And that was very impacting and interesting to discover that there was a smart person who
So you'd had this period of searching, you'd had this strange experience in the church. At what point would you say that your questions became, as it were, answered to the point at which you were able to embrace the Christian faith?
Yeah, there were a number of questions, and not all of them were central to my embracing Christianity. One of them was particularly helpful to resolve, and that was the very high standards I had about what sorts of reasons I should need in order to believe that God exists or that Jesus was raised from the dead. I had a very strong expectation that I should have a lot of argumentation or evidence for this, and it struck me that my reading of the gospel accounts about the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus could be taken as reliable witness, and that witness testimony wasn't unreliable, or that was perfectly fine as a way of knowing things. There's plenty of things that we know in life, not because we have a deductive argument for that conclusion, but simply because we know them because somebody reliable told us so. I mean, this is the way I know what my date of birth is. You know, I don't remember, I don't have any proof, but somebody I trust told me so. And I came to see the four accounts of the life of Jesus as basically reliable testimony of people who told me genuinely, hey, this is what I've seen. So my question in intellectually shifted from give me a reason to believe to, well, these people are telling me this is what happens, give me a reason to doubt. So that's a shift intellectually that was starting to occur. But then I shifted my prayer life as an unbeliever, and I asked God, look, these things start to make sense to me, but now I'm going to need to have you reveal yourself to me in very explicit ways that I'm comfortable jumping in, and I'll know you'll catch me. I won't make a fool out of myself if I make this big life change. And the one thing happened in the process of that is that God reactivated my conscience that had been seared for years. It so happens that just about at the same time this investigation began, I had myself engaged in very atrocious immoral sin against that person. And I'm not at liberty to give all the details on the public radio, but it was pretty extreme, even by my own atheistic moral standards. And just in the short amount of time, God reactivated my conscience, where all of those things I had done, which I knew I had done, came straight up in my face, and I was struck with guilt, intense physical guilt, physical pain out of the guilt of having done those things. And it's from that place that all of a sudden the things I had been reading and talking about with this pastor made perfect sense. Now I understood the gospel. Jesus died on the cross so that he could pay the price for my sins. And so I received that gospel, the good news that I didn't gain my salvation by my good works, but by simply placing my faith in Jesus, I received the forgiveness that he purchased for on the cross. So that was a very strong light bulb experience where I understood the gospel. I had read the claims, and it didn't make any sense to me. Why did Jesus have to die? And from that place where God reactivated my conscience, it turned on the light, and I figured, I'm all in. I get it. And so I embraced the gospel. I told God, you know, I'm giving you my life. I received the sacrifice of Jesus by faith alone. And from there, the guilt just evaporated. Every trace of guilt departed. And I experienced this spiritual renewal of embraces, knowing that I was forgiven, knowing that I had experienced the living God.
And this was when, everything changed for you, Guillaume. And that was the short version. But I think it was important to tell that story so that we could hear kind of the basis on which we're going forward in this discussion. I'm keenly aware, though, that we haven't heard properly yet from our other guest, and so we'll do that now. And if you want to get in touch yourself about anything you hear on today's show, let me just remind you the ways to do that. unbelievable@premier.org.uk is the email address if you want to send in your thoughts. You can find us, of course, on Facebook, Twitter, all the social media channels and so on. Go to the all-new, brand-spanking, unbelievable webpage to find out the links. premier.org.uk/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Right, let's hear the other story on today's show. It is a show where we're giving over a certain amount of time to the stories because I think they're important before we get to the actual discussion element. And so forgive us for doing it that way, but I'm certainly interested to hear both these stories. Wade, thank you for coming on. Tell us a little bit about your background as well, where you grew up and what kind of religious observance you had in your life.
I was born and raised in the Phoenix area in Arizona, and lived there until I was not quite 18. I turned 18 after I joined the military and moved out of the state. But I was born and baptized Roman Catholic. In fact, I actually still rather identify with that in a powerful and kind of nostalgic way. Mm. It's been a big part of my life. I still have, I think, fairly profound meditative experiences in my mother's old church where I was baptized, where I'd witnessed a number of marriages, and I think where even my old baptismal certificate is still stored. After my mother remarried, we had eventually, as a family, she and I converted to my father's religion, or my adoptive father's religion, which was Episcopalianism. And we sort of stuck there as a family for a long time. Mine, it wasn't an ideal family situation. It was actually quite troubled, quite disturbed. Lots of illnesses. My father had for a time lost his own eyesight for, probably a year and a half. He had severe cataracts before they were corrected. And my mother was severely mentally ill. So there was a lot of disruption, but our participation, you know, particularly in the Episcopal Church, was pretty important. Hmm. And also, you know, not a small smattering of Southern Baptist, very, very close, I suppose you'd say, sort of honorary family members, yeah. Had brought me into that. In fact, some of my most uncomfortable memories with them were altar calls as a teenager, and I can still feel the eyes on me.
Did you respond at some point?
When I was an adult, I responded with discomfort. Okay. to those altar calls as a teenager, but up to that point, you know, almost yearly Baptist summer schools, so which I loved, hmm. which were great,
and in that sense, far more opportunity to respond to a call of the gospel.
Certainly.
than obviously Guillaume had, where it almost seemed like a very bizarre twist of fate was mm-hmm. necessary to get him to the point of even considering Christianity.
Well, I think for my part, you know, a lot of it, I sort of felt like my arm was twisted behind my back much of the time.
Okay.
For that. We were already established as Episcopalians, and that was comfortable. I mean, it was a comfortable, friendly, social sort of situation.
You know, but you did embrace a sort of a personal faith as an adult.
Certainly, yeah.
Mid-20s was this?
Mid-20s, 25, 26, around that time. And it was actually before I'd come to be diagnosed with the disorder that would lead to my blindness. It was, you know, there were altar calls. It was Southern Baptist denomination. Mm-hmm. And I'd finally responded, and I actually felt quite good about it at the time. In fact, I know you'd had Oz Guinness on
recently.
Not long ago, and he had mentioned those sort of pivotal experiences.
Yeah.
And I profoundly believe that I'd had a number of those.
Yeah. Now, as you say, and I should have perhaps mentioned this earlier on, you do suffer from visual impairment. So you've got about 5% of a normal vision, as mm-hmm. it were. This kind of was something that developed in your later 20s, then, was it?
And it was quite slow.
And went alongside also you starting to question this faith that you'd
No,
accepted,
actually,
or...
you know, it had when I was discharged from the military, I have a very clear memory of leaving my station for the last time and feeling profoundly guided with no troubling, you know, anxiety or dismay or disappointment. I knew that I would eventually go blind, and you know, it felt very purposeful.
Okay.
So
you didn't then, that didn't particularly play into a kind of a sense of why has God allowed this to happen?
No. If that ever happened at all, it was with my mother's mental illness. In fact, there were a few poor Episcopal priests that I was not so nice to in making these, you know, putting these questions to. So, I mean, I was very troubled in that sense for her sake and for my family's.
Sure. What were the main things then that started to make you doubt your faith that you had embraced?
You know, I think it had been coming up. I had, in my mid-teens, I had started reading the classics, I think probably beginning with the Gilgamesh epic, a number of things that sort of, you know, they did have religious implications, but they were existential. They sort of brought people together in very basic ways. Mm. And the way I'd come to define existentialism in that sense were the things that we had in common, not just the anxieties, but, you know, the love, the affection, the friendship, those kinds of things. And I realized that they were independent of my faith. Even the idea, I mean, sort of the pivotal concept for my own Christianity after I'd adopted it as an adult was Jesus's friend. And that was very important to me. But it's a very human concept, and it's extremely profound.
At what point did the doubts eventually accumulate to the point at which you actually said, no, I don't think I am a Christian anymore. I think I've become, and more than that even, decided to become an atheist?
You know, I never actually decided to really become an atheist. I sort of slipped slowly into agnosticism, and it was, you know, along with this questioning that I just mentioned and the importance of just the human aspect of my experience, it felt like a natural move away from it. There were a few things. You know, one of the things I'd come to realize with Christianity, it sort of came in the form of shunning and, you know, variously called excommunication, disfellowship, exclusion, marginalization, these sorts of things that were sort of endemic to Christianity, the making of others, of other people.
Right.
That was probably one of the things that led more profoundly to it. I eventually, you know, I'd been having these conversations with theologian friends for a time. In fact, I was probably so geeked out on it. One of my, up to that point, favorite birthday gifts was a subscription to Biblical Archaeology Review. I was terribly geeked out on it. So it just in the last few years, I would say, I had started to refer to myself as an atheist.
Right.
And it had a lot to do with entering these conversations. But more precisely, I'd say agnostic atheist. Mm. It's not the atheism part, you know, God's non-existence isn't something I feel that I can ever prove or demonstrate.
Sure.
But I do live my life as though...
As though there is no God.
Precisely.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, very interesting. And thank you again for sharing that story. And we can open both these stories up a little bit more across the rest of today's program. You're listening to an edition of Unbelievable in which I'm joined by both a new convert, a relatively recent convert to Christianity, and someone who deconverted. So Guillaume Bignon is a French theologian who was an atheist only several years ago. A series of personal events, as we heard, and an intellectual journey led him to investigate Christianity and to embrace it. Wade Paget, who we've just been hearing from there, actually went in the opposite direction from Christian belief to atheism. We're talking today about their stories, and we're going to be hearing essentially what justifies believing or not believing, and we're going to be hearing your thoughts as well, of course, later on in today's program. We've done other similar issues to this not so long ago, so do stay tuned to Unbelievable here on Premier Christian Radio, and don't forget you can get in touch as well by emailing unbelievable@premier.org.uk. We'll be back in just a moment's time.
Premier Christianity, for cutting-edge commentary and encouraging stories. Tackling the big issues to help you live out your faith.
I'm not the man I used to be. The words of megachurch pastor Rick Warren as he speaks to us in the July edition about his life a year on from the tragic suicide of his son Matthew. Plus, we've your essential guide to how your church can make the most of World Cup fever and the extraordinary stories coming out of the Middle East of undercover miracles among Muslims. Plus, news, reviews, and your favourite columnists.
For your free copy of Premier Christianity, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample. You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to Unbelievable this Saturday afternoon. I'm Justin Brierley. Special guests today are Guillaume Bignon and Wade Paget. One is a recently converted atheist to Christianity. The other, and not so recently, I'm not sure exactly what the timeline is on your story, Wade, but certainly was a Christian and now calls himself an atheist. So we're talking about conversion and deconversion today with my two guests. If you want to get in touch yourself, as I've mentioned, you can do that via email, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Don't forget we're available on Twitter and Facebook too, at UnbelievableJB or facebook.com/UnbelievableJB. All those links and, of course, links to where you can find out more about my two guests from the website of Unbelievable. That's premier.org.uk/Unbelievable. And it is a newly revamped and special-looking website, so do go there to find out more about today's show. Okay, we've been hearing then, just in that last section, Guillaume, something of Wade's story, going in the opposite direction, effectively, to you. Anything you wanted to say, kind of, as you heard that story? I mean, one thing that struck me, as I mentioned, was that, in a sense, Wade had many more opportunities to hear the gospel than you did. I don't know if that kind of is something you've thought about in the course of your own story, Guillaume.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the fact that I even had to overcome all those obstacles before I could even hear anything that sounds remotely like Christianity was an interesting aspect of my conversion. But there's not much that I need to say by way of interaction with his story so far, and certainly not my role to discredit or criticize his decision. But there's one aspect that strikes me as a former atheist becoming a Christian, is that much of this discussion speaks about the experience with the church and his family's background, his thinking process. But in terms of at least his conversion to Christianity, if we can speak of a conversion, but being raised in the cultural aspect, but I didn't really hear much of a focus on the gospel. That is that my conversion experience was very much rooted in my coming to understand that I'm a sinner, that Jesus paid the price for sin on the cross, and that it's received by faith alone, and it's a free gift of God. Now, that very central claim of Christianity is definitional to me of what hearing and receiving the gospel is, and I don't think there is a Christianity without the gospel. So hearing the conversion, and maybe it was there, you know, he says that he heard various altar calls. I don't know how explicit those altar calls were about the nature of sin, the nature of Christ's work on the cross and saving faith. But it seems to me that a genuine conversion to Christianity involves receiving the gospel. Wade, maybe you want to fill me in and tell me that it was, in fact, an important part of your Christianity, or was that always more in the background?
Oh, no, certainly you're right. I mean, it was so profound, and in fact, I probably just took it for granted and didn't say very much about it, but definitely there. And when I mentioned Jesus as friend, you know, I believe that's from out of John. It's been a while since I've looked at it, but that was a big part of it. And confessing with my mouth, you know, acknowledging my fallen nature, and that I was a sinner, and that, you know, I was guilty by nature, basically. All of those were a part of my own conscious decision to convert as an adult. Okay. So, certainly.
Did you experience anything in any measure like that Guillaume obviously had a very, as well as having this intellectual journey, a very sort of personal, emotional experience of feeling that he had been forgiven, of feeling this guilt that came off his shoulders at the moment he prayed that prayer. Did you have anything that might be seen as similar to that?
You know, I actually at the time didn't feel especially guilty. I mean, there were one or two things, but you know, probably my most profound emotional experience was the one that I'd mentioned. You know, this feeling of purpose following my diagnosis, and then basically leaving a career that I intended to spend much of the rest of my life in.
And when you say purpose, do you mean that
that God had a purpose
that
for me,
purpose and for you in that process?
Exactly, and that I was very comfortable in it.
Yeah,
it was very warm.
But in a sense, did you just come to eventually feel that, well, that obviously wasn't what was happening in
yes.
that situation?
Oh, certainly, yeah. I did. You know, part of it was rooted in the experience I'd already had. And, you know, again, you know, so many of these experiences, you know, apart from that feeling of purpose, that one as well, though, I mean, they're so common and they're so human, you know, whether they're experiences of love, companionship, purpose as well, they're not just religious experiences.
Sure. I mean, it does raise this question, Guillaume, of to what extent our personal experience when it comes to conversion is important in terms of giving evidence for. I mean, your story I find very powerful, Guillaume, because it, for me, speaks on both an intellectual and sort of emotional level. To me as a Christian, I don't know how it might speak to someone like Wade, but do you find that for you, that kind of that aspect of your story, the moment you couldn't step foot out of the church, the moment that you felt this weight being lifted off you, that's just as important in terms of the way that the evidential value of that as the actual kind of investigating whether this story is true stuff?
Yes, that's right, Justin. I think there are two ways in which such events are of value in knowing and showing Christianity to be true. And I think the way of thinking about it that William Lane Craig distinguishes between knowing Christianity to be true and showing Christianity to be true is of value here, because I think those experiences participate in both of those tasks, but they are much more efficient in one than the other. So let me explain. In my coming to knowing Christianity to be true, those experiences served very strongly as an occasion of my forming beliefs that Christianity was true, but they are very questionable if they are used as premises in a deductive argument to the truth that Christianity is actually true. So you can take my experiences, you know, take my shoulder becoming invalid right after I prayed. Well, if I press this as a deductive argument, it commits the fallacy of post hoc ergo propter hoc, which is to say it happens afterwards, therefore it happens because of that.
Sure.
That's logic. Valid. So that's not a sound way of reasoning. In a similar way, I could just say, well, you know, when I got blocked by this experience at the door of the church, maybe it was just my own psychological state. I was emotional that day. Maybe it's what I had for breakfast. You know, there's a number of explanations. So it's not that this truth of the event entails logically that God grabbed me by the throat, but in the context in which they happen, they ground my experience to form a belief in God that I see as warranted, justified, proper, or whichever positive thing you can say about a belief that makes it a true case of knowledge, even though I can't necessarily use it as a deductive argument.
Sure.
So that's the one side. It serves to for me to know, and I think it was a proper mechanism for me to come to know Christianity is true. And it has a more modest value, though not no value at all. It's just a more modest value in showing Christianity to be true.
Wade, when it comes to the experiences that one has, what kind of level at which is that an important thing, even in a deconversion, I suppose? I mean, you talked about the fact that your experience of seeing the way some Christians and churches treated people who were different to themselves was also a factor in you coming to question and eventually abandon your faith.
Sure, and it wasn't just the way they viewed people who were different to themselves. It was making them different to themselves. It was forming new beliefs about those people to make them, you know, again, as someone like Martin Buber would say, to turn them into other, and to alienate them. And that's, you know, it's Christianity can practically be defined by its tendency to fragment. And I think that's an aspect of it, is that, you know, one Christian turns another into an other, so to speak. And it's done with non-Christians as well. As far as belief is concerned, you know, I think it's terribly important. I've not focused very heavily on evidence, per se. You know, so I'm not going to, in fact, I don't have very much interest in convincing Christians that they're wrong or dispelling their belief, but sort of switching to, you know.
So you're not an evangelistic atheist.
I am not an evangelistic atheist. No, in fact, I rather admire Alain de Botton. You know, I'd almost like to make atheism a non-issue. It's not such a big thing. What I come to for myself is that if it's a matter of belief, it's a question of belief, it's important for me to ask myself if I need to believe this, if I want to believe it, and answer the question either way, whichever the question is. And, you know, if that need isn't there, then, you know, for instance, for whatever the reason, and I'm not necessarily going to analyze Guillaume's motivation. So I have come to look very closely at motivation as an aspect of belief. You know, looking at why we're motivated to believe in the first place. And it's a complex, very complex sort of system. But just starting with those questions, do I need to believe? Do I want to believe? If so, why? If not, why? And then going from there.
I suppose it runs in both directions, though, in as much as
certainly.
Equally someone might have motivations of all kinds to drop their belief if it's in some way.
Sure.
You know, advantageous to them at some level.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, speaking to Guillaume's case, one of the reasons, not that he necessarily dropped a belief but never had one or never acquired one. Guillaume, you'd mentioned, you know, the conquest of women, you know, the pursuit of pleasure. So who would want to stifle that with, you know, with stereotypically Christian prohibitions against promiscuous sex and, you know, everything that goes along with it? It's very basically, you know, switching to kind of psychotherapist and cognitive scientist mode, belief is a state. And this is one of the reasons I'm less interested in evidence, is when we're asked to justify our beliefs, most of the time I think really it's not the beliefs we need to justify, it's the certainty that we have with regard to the beliefs or the state of knowing. Robert Burton.
So you would like it if all Christians and atheists to some extent held their beliefs a little less certain, certainly.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, it's the kind of the dogmatism that maybe is mm-hmm. more of an issue.
Yeah.
What's your thinking on that, Guillaume?
Well, I'm not sure about the degree of certainty. It's always very difficult to describe exactly what that looks like, a degree of certainty. The way I would phrase it is simply that our beliefs can be warranted in the sense that we've come to form a belief that's an actual case of knowledge. And the way that my experience grounds this, I would think, is very much along the lines of what Alvin Plantinga describes as being the proper basicality of Christian belief. That is, that it's not a belief that I form on the basis of a deductive argument, my religious experience being a premise of that. It's none of that sort. It's just a belief that we properly form out of an appropriate experience, and yet it's a genuine case of knowledge, even though there's no independent evidence supporting it. Examples of this would be our belief that the outside world is real. My sense experience that there is an outside world is completely undifferentiated from if I was a brain in a vat stimulated to think and feel exactly the way I am. Yet I form a belief that the outside world is real. It's a properly basic belief. I don't have any evidence to support it, but it's just a natural thing to do, and it's rational, and it's putting me in touch with reality. That is, it's an actual case of knowledge. Similarly, our beliefs in the laws of logic are not things that we derive from something else. The fact that two propositions that contradict one another cannot both be true is not something I know on the basis of something else. It's just a properly basic belief. Now, the risk with those kinds of beliefs not supported by other independent evidence is that now we can say, well, maybe anything is up for grabs. Maybe our beliefs can be completely arbitrary and there's nothing wrong to the matter. And so the answer to that objection is to simply say, no, a properly basic belief needs to be grounded in an experience that makes it a case of genuine knowledge. In the case of the outside world, it's grounded upon my experience, my sensory perception of the outside world. And so I would posit my religious experience very much like that. The set of events that occurred to me that are very remarkable don't deductively entail that Christianity is true, but they serve as the proper occasion of my forming a belief in Christianity. It's a genuine case of knowledge where the belief is properly basic and it's warranted, justified, rational. It's the good thing to do in light of this experience.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Wade, what's your feeling then on this whole idea of certain beliefs being warranted? And no, it's not a sort of deductive argument, but from Guillaume's perspective, I suppose he's got every good reason to include his experience as part of that process of coming to weigh if these beliefs should be held or not.
Sure. I would say properly basic in this case could be translated into simply being satisfied at a particular point, you know, less evidence, less additional experience, less inference, that you come to a point, you know, where you're not necessarily going to be able to collect absolutely uncontestable, conclusive evidence. But, you know, as with all of us in any belief where we need to move forward, that you decide that there's a point at which you're satisfied. And I think that's a common experience. It sounds like, and again, without necessarily wanting to dispel your beliefs or to be overly analytical, you know, it really does sound like you've taken a series of circumstances and, you know, what otherwise would be coincidences, and said this led to this, led to this, led to this. And then I felt like I had sufficiently sufficient reason to just be satisfied with settling here at this point of belief. And you did. I wouldn't necessarily say you shouldn't. My own attitudes with regard to speaking with Christians, you know, are always going to come back to how we treat one another. And as long as you're dealing with other people in a fair, and this, the same could, you know, properly basic belief for me could be described in the same way. I believe that my ideas of fairness and compassion, for instance, are properly basic. You know, they're verified by my experience, and I do believe that they're correct.
Even if you don't have a kind of necessarily a metaphysical grounding for that, you think it's, yeah. I mean, I was going to say, Guillaume, sort of, can an atheist in that sense have some kind of properly basic belief that their beliefs don't have to be grounded in God or whatever?
If I can interject before Guillaume answers, you know, Guillaume, you did make a mention of your own atheistic morality being, you know, even that, I think the expression was used, even that was violated by the incident or the series of incidents that caused you guilt, which I found kind of...
Well, yeah, because perhaps it's being a bit pejorative about what an atheist, how an atheist behaves or something. But I mean, Guillaume, sure. do you want to come back on that?
Yeah, no, let me qualify this, because I make no judgment as to what... the moral life is of Wade right now. The way I meant this expression is simply that in my atheistic reasoning, I was driven by very few moral beliefs outside of what I felt was right to me.
Sure.
And so with that moral compass and what I understand to be the fallen nature of human beings, my moral standards were driven very low as to what I could or could not do. Now, I don't mean to claim that Wade is living his life in the same way, but that's the way that my belief led. Now, in terms of morality, I'm of the conviction that only if God exists can objective moral values exist. So obviously, I do hold that kind of belief, but that says nothing about the way an atheist will live, in fact, his life. It only tells you something that in the way he should maintain certain beliefs about the objective nature of morality, but that's really a separate story. So
I mean,
I didn't mean to be...
No, but it was good to get that qualification. Is the way that Wade expressed the idea that he felt what you're talking about when you say you felt your belief was warranted by this kind of basicality, was essentially you felt satisfied that you could settle on this because of the experiences you'd had? I mean, is that another way of putting it? Could Wade equally say, well, I'm satisfied with the experiences I've had have led me to this point, so I've got a properly basic belief as well, as you, Guillaume?
Yeah, so the availability of properly basic beliefs is clearly open to everybody. So anybody, regardless of whether they believe in God, is open to form properly basic beliefs that are going to be accurate. I mean, I'm sure that Wade believes in the reality of the past or in the laws of logic, and he's warranted in that properly basic belief. So the question becomes, can an atheist be justified in the same sense? Could he have a properly basic belief that's the case of knowledge that God does not exist? Well, obviously, for coherence sake, my answer would have to be no, because we cannot have knowledge of two contradictory beliefs. If God does exist, then it's impossible to know that he does not exist, because knowledge requires at least truth. Even though it requires more than truth, it requires some degree of warrant. But the way I would phrase it for the atheistic side is simply to say that the warrant of a belief, according to Alvin Plantinga, it's you have a genuine knowledge in the face of a properly basic belief when that belief is produced by cognitive faculties that are functioning properly in an environment that is friendly to them and according to a design plan successfully aimed at truth. So I know it's a mouthful, but it's a way of saying that as a Christian, I believe that our cognitive faculties were designed by God. We have a mind that is designed by God to access truth. On the atheistic side, we must believe without the existence of God that our brains were designed by chance to save our skin. That is, that they were designed by natural selection in order to save our skin. So that model is very unfriendly toward the proper basicality of beliefs formed by our cognitive faculties, because it entails that the reason why we have those faculties is not so that we can form true belief, but so that we could save our skins, which may or may not use, it certainly doesn't care about whether our beliefs are true. So with that model of what a properly basic belief is, I would argue that it's possible for a Christian to maintain a properly basic belief in God's existence, while on the opposite side, it's impossible for an atheist to have such a similarly warranted belief in the non-existence of God.
Mm, okay, well, let's pick that up. You can tell you're talking to a theologian, an atheist turned theologian here, can't you, Wade? But
yes.
I don't know if you've ever interacted in the past with these particular arguments from Alvin Plantinga. I know we did a show a while
they're
basically, back
on this. Yeah. They're based on modal logic, which I think is...
And this interesting, essentially Guillaume spelt out in brief the evolutionary argument against naturalism there, which is another interesting aspect of his work. But... for him, the fact that you have to believe, if you are an atheist, that the brain is produced by a non-rational process, which is about survival of the fittest rather than producing truth necessarily, means that it's actually much harder for an atheist to claim to have a warranted belief in anything, because of they can't have the same trust in their own cognitive faculties, essentially.
Well, and that basically ignores the fact that they actually do have trust, just like everybody else in their cognitive faculties. That the brain, again, switching to cognitive scientist mode, that the brain doesn't care whether or not it's true. It doesn't necessarily even care that it's about survival. It may just care that it feels okay or that we're safe. Or that we've not made the worst mistake as opposed to the better mistake. Mm. There's a concept in cognitive science called adaptive bias, which basically says the nervous system doesn't care about truth. It cares about minimizing the cost of mistakes. We're at a level in examining, natural selection, evolution, that sort of thing. We're nowhere near... we're nowhere near where we will be in 100 years. We're, I think it's analogous to where Galileo was when he was contemplating the heavens. Certainly there are going to be mistakes and misnomers, and 100 years from now, there are probably going to be evolutionary biologists who are going to say, what Dawkins said was ridiculous. And, and everybody will believe that. But, discussing warrant, it's almost irrelevant. A warrant is about conventions in argument. And while I think it's, I love it, I love talking with theologians and I love these issues myself. It's kind of brain candy. In terms of just how we live our lives, I don't use a warrant. I don't argue my morals, and I don't need to for the most part. And as you say, they are properly basic, whether I have a sufficient warrant or not. My beliefs are, I can stop at the point. I can be satisfied with the idea that my beliefs are simply states.
Right. So you wouldn't even talk about them as being true or false. You'd just say... this is where my brain is at this point.
I wouldn't even separate myself from my brain. And this is, this is where I am. My brain, referring to my brain in the second person is really just it's a kind of convenient way of talking about a brain and a personality.
Before we go to a break, Guillaume, do you want to just have a quick stab at this?
Yeah, I don't mean to pursue that field too far outside of the topic of our conversation, but there's one point I want to pick upon, and it's the fact that Wade sounds like he's granting me more than the new atheists are prepared to grant. Namely, he's saying, I don't necessarily clearly want to challenge the claim that Guillaume's experience warrants his belief that Christianity is true. And that sounds to me like it's granting us a whole lot. That's it. That is, even though he doesn't believe that God exists, he admits that the particular environment in which I was placed as a result of those experiences and arguments has placed me in a place where it's reasonable for me to be a Christian. And that is a fantastic thing to hear from him, but that's not what the new atheist would have
us believe. Let's just make sure then that the Wade is prepared to grant that. Is it reasonable, as far as you're concerned, for Guillaume to be a Christian, given his experiences past and his current belief?
Certainly, and it might even be a mark of his good character. You know, I see none of us, you know, anybody certainly raised in Europe or the Americas can really tease the Christianity out of their lives. You know, I hear this. I deal with a lot of Reformed Christians, Reformed fundamentalist Christians who argue very strongly about this idea of, you know, borrowed capital, as though the Christian influence can be teased away from, you know, a nationality or a culture or even someone's personal life. And it can't. You know, what I believe about my moral life, I really can't tease the Christianity out of that.
We're going to go to a break. We'll pick this up again in just a moment's time. Guillaume Bignon is with me by Skype from New York. He's a Frenchman, though, and he was an atheist until not so long ago. He's now a theologian, and we've been talking about his story and what it means for someone to have the evidence they need to embrace faith or indeed to reject faith. Wade Paget went in the opposite direction from Christian belief to atheism. So join us again in a short moment's time as we continue today's edition of Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. Welcome back to the third final part of Unbelievable today with me, Justin Brierley. And you're listening this Saturday afternoon on Premier Christian Radio, it'll be no surprise that this is actually a pre-recorded version of today's programme, because Unbelievable, the conference, is actually happening today at Westminster Central Hall. And I'll be making sure you get a full rundown of what transpired on the day and how you can get yourself, if you're not able to attend, a copy of the DVD and the CD that we're producing in relation to that. So make sure to come back and find out more about that later on. You can also find, of course, details to do with today's programme, my guests, at the website, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Worth going there just to see the new look of the Premier Christian Radio site. So that's very exciting as well. A bit later on in today's programme, we'll be getting some of your feedback to the last few weeks of programming. We've had some really interesting debates between people like Oz Guinness and Ed Atkinson. He was another ex-Christian who came on for that discussion a couple of weeks ago. We had last week's one, which was Lynn Wilder, a former Mormon, in debate with a Mormon apologist. So lots of interesting feedback to both of those programmes that we'll be bringing you in a moment's time. Don't forget that later on today you can hear the Profile interview. A really special guest joins me for the Profile this Saturday afternoon between 4 and 5. Rick Warren is a major church leader in the States. He's a best-selling author, and I sat down with him recently to talk about his life and faith, particularly, of course, in relation to the last year since the tragic suicide of his youngest son, Matthew. So hear that conversation between us between 4 and 5 this afternoon. A number of people have been asking, and I'm sure this again will generate those questions, when are we going to get the Profile interview online, Justin? When are you going to be broadcasting that via the internet so we can hear it? Plans are afoot with the launch of this new website, newly relaunched Premier Christian Radio website. I will be making sure that you get to know how to do that, how you can download these Profile interviews from Saturday afternoons. That's the outlook for the rest of the afternoon. I hope you can keep it here on Premier. Let's get back into the final part of today's discussion.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
And we've been talking about conversion and deconversion. My two guests are Guillaume Bignon. He's a French theologian. He was an atheist until recently, and we heard the story at the outset of today's programme about the circumstances that led him to embrace Christianity. Similarly, we heard the circumstances that led Wade Paget, my other guest today, to drop Christianity in the end in favour of atheism. We've talked about warranted belief, basicality, what it takes for us to believe, and so on. just as we start to close today's programme, Guillaume, what do you think is the benefit of the conversion story and that experience in terms of evangelism and so on? This is an apologetics programme. We tend to focus on the, you know, the objective arguments, the kalam, cosmological argument, the moral argument, the this and that. We don't often, kind of, as it were, give a lot of space for that more personal appeal of this is what happened to me and let me tell you about it. What for you is the place for that within a considered view of Christianity?
Well, the first thing is to pick up on your contrast between the intellectual arguments, like an argument from design or not, or cosmological arguments and so on. A conversion story that features the kind of events that happened to me is actually not too far from offering what it takes to present a good argument for God's existence. It does serve as a sort of argument from design. That is that in the way we detect design, we expect two criteria. Bill Dembski has done a work on this issue of how you detect design. And he says that what you need is you have a high improbability and an independently given pattern. That is, if I, we use this in very common field. Let's say, if I'm trying to detect whether or not a song is doing plagiarism and it's actually ripping off of another song, I'm going to be assessing whether there was an intent, a design in there by looking at how improbable it is that the songs match to this degree. And then looking at the independently given pattern, namely, this song is as improbable as any other, but it matches an independently given pattern, namely, it matches the original song. Similarly, in lots of fields, this test has been applied in, whether it's applicable to biology or the fine-tuning of the universe is a separate question. But I would say, why not apply it to a conversion story like mine? There is a highly improbable set of events that happened to me, and they match an independently given pattern of namely what a God would like to do if he wanted to bring me to Christian faith. So it seems like it's not a deductive argument that has full force, but it does serve as an intellectual argument from design that would say, highly improbable events matching an independently given pattern would challenge you to consider whether or not, in fact, it wasn't designed by God who just wanted to reveal himself to me. So that's just to tackle the intellectual argument aspect of it.
Yeah, I mean, but if we can stay on that for a moment before we get into that. I mean, my immediate response would be, Guillaume, but in a sense, the fact that you are one Frenchman among millions who were perhaps in a similar situation to you, for whom maybe they haven't had that experience, could that not just be suggested that, well, you are that chance fluke, you know, where a certain set of circumstances did you lead you down this road, but it is because there are millions of other Frenchmen for whom it didn't happen, you just happen to be the one that it happened to.
Yeah, I hear you. The assessment of the probabilities is not in that context that I would place it. That is, what I describe as improbable is that the coincidences of my feeling the way I felt when I left the church or in my losing my shoulder a week after I prayed, those are the improbable events.
Okay.
And they don't really have a lot to do with the number of French people around me. To give you a correct analogy, it would be like saying, look, there's all these songs around in the world and none of them really matches your song. So that's proof that my song that I just wrote that copies it is not actually designed after yours. The existence of the other songs that don't plagiarize your song is no evidence that mine doesn't either. Does that make sense?
I think I see where you're coming from there. But Wade's looking a little quizzical, so I'll get some feedback from him in a moment. What was your second point? What was your second point before we do that?
Yeah, the other is that, wholly aside from arguments, to answer your question about the value in evangelism and personal appeal, I would say preaching the gospel is about Jesus and it's not about me. So I want to encourage Christians who use their conversion story to make sure they make the gospel the focus of their evangelism. They need to say that Jesus died on the cross, that he paid the price for sins, and if you repent and believe in him, you will be saved freely by grace. That's the gospel. But now, within that, giving a personal conversion story serves, and you see that in the New Testament. I mean, Luke makes a big deal of Saul's conversion and renaming into Paul. He had a pretty dramatic conversion to Jesus, and he uses that in the book of Acts to explain this is remarkable, and this is something that should challenge you to consider it as well. And the way Paul phrases it in Philippians, he's recounting his resume. He's putting it on the table. He says, I was circumcised on the eighth day. I was the Pharisee of Pharisees of the tribe of Benjamin. So he's essentially making the case that his He's taken their lifestyle as Hebrews. He's taken it to the maximum of the best that they could do with it. And he says, even, you know, I did better than you at that. Mm-hmm. And yet I count it as loss for the sake of knowing Christ. So there's a little bit of that value in a conversion like mine, where I can say, look, I pursued my pleasure and was doing pretty well on all those fronts, whether it was studying or sports or music, and I was very accomplished. But none of that is of any worth compared to Christ and the fact that I have found my purpose in life and that he's redeemed me and make me a son of God. So the contrast between this and the gospel is very valuable in the way you present the gospel in a compelling way.
Hmm. Okay, well, let's maybe take both of those from your perspective on the other side of this argument, Wade. You did look a bit sort of not sure about the way that Guillaume presented the fact that you could see the various events that were involved in his conversion as somehow having this specified complexity, I suppose, that suggests
sure.
it itself is evidence for the existence of God. You didn't quite buy that.
No. I think you could take any number of circumstances out of someone's life and hold them up next to, you know, any one other and say, look, this is a unique set of circumstances compared to this referent. And this is one of the things, you know, whether it's talking about fine-tuning or evolution or people's personal experience, where this probabilistic language is used, in most cases, I think the word that's more proper to use is just implausible. People have a feeling of implausibility, that this thing followed this thing followed this thing.
Hmm.
And, you know, from an experimental perspective, for instance, you know, what do we know about what was happening with Guillaume's shoulder prior to the pain that disabled him? You know, for all we know, it was failing for weeks or months or years up to this point.
But it was at that particular moment in his story when it forced him to go to church that it was significant, presumably, for Guillaume.
Oh, sure. And that was also coincident with a woman that he'd met who was a Christian, that he'd followed into that church, or presumably, I'm making an assumption here, he'd in effect followed into Christianity. So I don't find this so surprising, really. You know,
but for you, the better explanation is chance, effectively.
Yeah, effectively chance. And, you know, we are pattern-seeking organisms. You know, it's what we do. It's one of the reasons we lose in certain tests against chimpanzees. Mm. You know, it's while they're being pragmatic and looking for the reward, you know, we're looking for a key pattern.
Would this equally apply, though, to your journey towards atheism, that was similarly a product of chance events, if you like?
Yeah, I'd say it was, if not chance, a set of specific circumstances.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't necessarily, in my case, certainly it doesn't mean that God doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
In Guillaume's case, it certainly doesn't mean that God does exist. It means that he believes God exists. You know,
and it means that you believe God doesn't exist.
I believe there's a good chance God doesn't exist.
Sure.
I don't know. And I've made the decision to live my life as though he doesn't. So, but, you know, really implausibility or incredulity is the thing that I keep coming back to with that kind of argument as opposed to improbability.
Do you want to respond on that one, Guillaume?
He's essentially saying, and that's the coherent position to take for the atheist, to say, well, these events that happened to Guillaume are just chance and coincidences. The fact that we are pattern-seeking creatures doesn't strike me as very relevant in our assessment of whether those patterns are there or not. When I look at Mount Rushmore and I see what seems to me like the faces of American presidents, I don't discount my knowledge that this is designed based on the fact that I'm prone to find patterns in nature. And the fact that all those other mountains don't have those faces, again, doesn't discredit my knowledge that these faces were actually the fruit of human design. So, you know, it's once again not a deductive argument with inevitable fault. You can always say, well, it was just chance or it was coincidence. But if the probabilities are low enough and the pattern matches, it seems to me we have all the ingredients to infer design properly.
No, and I wouldn't be interested in discrediting your argument that you believe. Certainly you do. But I'd ask, you know, if you looked at another scene, would, you know, have you ever seen anything that isn't there? You know, much of my training was in cognitive science and psychophysics. In fact, I spoke very recently with a psychophysicist who was my academic advisor in undergraduate training, who designs optical illusions, you know, who first exposed me to the idea of how an optical illusion can be connected to this broader idea of belief. Have you ever seen anything that wasn't there?
Yes, certainly. I think that what you're drawing my attention to is the fact that the cognitive faculties in play here are not infallible. And I think that's perfectly acceptable. I think we want to be careful that there is no deception in the way that those cognitive faculties are working. But the fact that they're not infallible doesn't do anything to discredit the warrants that they bring when they're actually functioning properly. So I think that's a fair point for you. It just doesn't undermine the knowledge that is brought about by my cognitive faculties in that case.
We are going to have to start to draw things to a close. It's been a really interesting encounter, this combination of both the interesting stories you both have, but also the intellectual sort of aspect that you bring to it and the thought journey, the intellectual journey you've been on, Guillaume, obviously, since having those very specific experiences that led you to feel that you were, you know, you should embrace Christianity. Wade, it's been great to have you on as well.
Thank you
for coming and making time in your trip here to the UK. Obviously, you'll be able to hear this when you're back in the States.
I love to listen to myself. It was a pleasure, really.
It's been great having you on, and look forward to maybe interacting at some point down the line as well.
Sure.
Guillaume, if you're ever in the UK, be interested to have you in person. It would be great to do that if possible.
Well, I will definitely be there to defend my doctoral thesis since my school is in London, so I will make sure we'll contact at that point.
Definitely. Okay, it would be wonderful to have you in person as well. So thanks both for being on for what's been a really interesting and invigorating discussion today on conversion and deconversion and the reasons we may have for and against those things. Perhaps you're interested in responding yourself. Perhaps you'd like to tell your story in either direction and what part evidence and experience played in your journey. Be interested to hear from you. I'll make sure to give out the ways to get in contact again in just a moment's time as we hear some of your feedback as well. You're listening to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, I look forward to hearing from you about today's show. And don't forget, you can email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can also find us online at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. That'll take you to the new website where you can find contact details for the show. Do check us out on Twitter and Facebook at unbelievablejb, facebook.com/unbelievablejb. Now, that website literally has just been launched. And so for the Unbelievable page, you may find, a little bit of a challenge to find your way around the new page. And if there's anything you spot that needs updating, please let us know, because it's a massive job when you're overhauling an entire website. But I hope you enjoy exploring that. Thanks to those who've been getting in touch by email. And let's have a few of these thoughts that have come in regard to recent shows. First of all, a new listener, Oliver, says, I listened to the show Unbelievable, would like to tell you how fantastic it is. I stumbled on the show quite randomly. I read the book Unapologetic by Francis Spufford last summer. Wanting to hear more from him, I Google searched to see if he had any interviews or other appearances. That's when I found on the Unbelievable website his discussion with the author Philip Pullman. I listened, very much enjoyed it. At the same time, saw the list of all your many other shows and noticed you hosted discussions with other writers I'd previously come across, such as Alistair McGrath. As a young Christian at university, I'm at a time in my life when believing what I was brought up to believe on automatically is no good anymore. Due to the challenges made to people of faith, especially in a university environment, one must think through one's beliefs carefully and question them to assure that they do have value and, if necessary, change them. Unbelievable has been very helpful in helping me engage with my faith and address those questions. I'd also like to congratulate you on being such a good moderator. Oh, thank you very much. And you wanted to also make some notes about science and some of the Catholic Protestant debates. Particularly, you feel that trying to explain the complexity of DNA and so on It's rather foolish of us, you say, to use God to explain things like that. I would see it as a scientific question that doesn't yet have a scientific answer. And if one is found and the history of science suggests it will find an answer, then we could end up looking rather silly. That's the so-called God of the Gaps argument, I suppose, isn't it, Oliver? Something we've debated a number of times on this show in one way or another. The other thing is, you say, some of the Catholic Protestant debates you've hosted. I was born and raised Roman Catholic, though I'm currently exploring other denominations, currently attending a Methodist church in my university town. Regarding Sola Scriptura, with an evangelical Protestant on one side and a Catholic on the other side, an impression is given that all Protestants follow Sola Scriptura, and it's the Catholics hold that Scripture alone is not sufficient. However, Sola Scriptura is not the position of all Protestant denominations. For instance, the Methodists see the Wesleyan quadruplet, i.e. Scripture, tradition, reason and experience, and many churches in the Anglican Communion hold a similar position. Thank you very much for getting in touch, Oliver, new listener. Mike from the USA says, I like your radio show a lot. I'm a fan. Last week's show, and that was Lynn Wilder, former Mormon, debating Michael Flournoy, a Mormon apologist. You thought Michael Flournoy did a good job in defending the Mormon church. Now, you are a Mormon yourself, Mike. You wanted to have a brief response, firstly, to the issue of John chapter 1, verse 1. You say it's talking about the beginning, not past eternity. Some evangelical scholars like Dr. Craig don't even believe in a past eternity. They believe God is outside time. And so John 1:1 doesn't contradict Mormon doctrine at all, you say. Secondly, much of the Joseph Smith translation is just commentary. So for John 1:1, the prophet Joseph Smith seems to be stressing that the word, Greek logos, was not only the pre-mortal Son of God, but also the gospel which he preached in the beginning. And thirdly, you say it's easy for us Mormons to defend the Book of Mormon, just as it's easy for evangelicals to respond to arguments against the Bible around sexism, slavery and genocide. Thank you very much. And number four, the Book of Mormon says God denieth none that come unto him, black and white, bond and free, male and female. And he remembered the heathen, and all are alike unto God, both Jew and Gentile, you say, in defense of the issue of racism. You say you'd like to see other Mormon apologists, for instance, from Fair Mormon, invited onto a debate on the show. Thank you for getting in touch. Good to hear from a Mormon responding to last week's program. Tim in Kobe, Japan, also on that, says it was good to have a practicing Mormon defend their position. Now, if only you could find a Jehovah's Witness to do the same. Here in Japan, both pseudo-Christian groups are very active, along with the Moonies. That would be another influential group that claimed to be Christian in some sense, that it would be great to have a substantive discussion with. Well, if you search far back enough in the archives, Tim, you will find we did a discussion debate with a Moonie, so to speak, several years ago. You say one thing that stood out to me in this dialogue was that it focused on theological issues in a way that each side could give their testimony about how they came to hold their beliefs. While that's all well and good, what was missing was the testing of those beliefs by objective criteria. When it comes to subjective faith claims, the best way to adjudicate between them is to test them against the established facts of history in the natural world. Christianity, of course, is a faith system based in real history that can be compared with the established facts of history. And when this is done, it stands up amazingly well. The exact opposite is the case with the claims of the Book of Mormon. Not a single place mentioned in the narrative has ever been confirmed from archaeology. Okay, thank you very much, Tim. Dax in Atlanta is an atheist, says, I found today's discussion a bit vapant. I would like to weigh in. Mrs. Wilder sounds friendly enough, but one thing kept coming to my mind when I listened to her speak. I think Bertrand Russell said it better than I could. The whole problem with the world is that fools and fanatics are so sure of themselves and wiser men so full of doubts. Mrs. Wilder has jumped straight from the furnace of Mormonism into the fire of Christianity, but now she is so sure. I'm willing to bet the passionate testimony she has of her Christian conversion was an echo of the one she gave when she found Mormonism. I think her time would be well served looking at the foundations of Christianity as she has the foundation of Mormonism, says Dax. Okay, fair enough. And Neil says, okay, we're moving now to the show before. Oz Guinness and the ex-Christian, that was Ed Atkinson, debating why Ed lost his faith and whether we sort of have to have ultimate meaning and purpose in life. This from Neil says, Justin, I just listened to the discussion. I was thinking to myself, as you might have been, that the skeptic has an ace up the sleeve to counter anything whatsoever, Oz might say. And that is that evolution has been shown to be capable of producing everything that can be observed regarding life and human society. This needs to be shown to be false scientifically in order to have a chance to counter that kind of fallback position for promoting atheism or agnosticism. No amount of philosophical debate will accomplish the necessary quality of information to influence that kind of skeptic. And so you suggest you'd like to see shows debating the capabilities of molecular evolution to produce the complexity we see. Michael Behe, Sean Pittman, Fuzz Rana, etc. versus people like P.Z. Myers, Larry Moore and Jerry Coyne. Well, of course, I'm sure if you're familiar with the archive of Unbelievable, Neil, you'll know that we have done a number of those shows in the past, featuring some of those leading people like Michael Behe and Stephen Meyer up against, some atheists and indeed Christians who come from an evolutionary perspective. So it's not that we haven't done it. Perhaps we haven't done it terribly recently, but thank you for getting in touch as well. OK, have we got time for one more? Adam says, Clay Jones, going back to that show with Richard Norman, the debate on suffering. The point was made that God doesn't interfere with our free will. To do so is as absurd as suggesting that God must prevent every single occurrence of, for instance, a mobile phone being used when driving, which could lead to an accident, or a knife being used to stab someone turning to rubber. Well, I agree, but where does this leave miracles and healing? Our natural bodies are subject to the choices we make using free will. This may cause disease, for example, excessive drinking causing liver failure, smoking causing heart disease, etc. So if there is faith healing, is that not as much a violation of the metal blade turning to rubber or any miraculous healing for that matter? Free will and natural law seem to go together, and any sudden divine intervention in either seems a violation of those. I would answer that to say that I don't think that Clay or any other Christian is saying because of free will, God can never act miraculously to intervene. And of course, Christianity is based on a miraculous intervention in the raising of Jesus Christ. It's more that it's the level to which God intervenes. So I think most Christians are perfectly happy to affirm God does intervene miraculously in certain situations where there is an obvious ultimate outcome which fits within that greater purpose, but that we shouldn't expect that necessarily all of the time, because then that would significantly take away free will. But where that line gets drawn, where at what point God, as it were, does so much that actually free will is being overridden, is, of course, I suppose, something only God's in a position to judge. Anyway, thank you for getting in touch. You say you really enjoyed the Oz Guinness and Ed Atkinson show as well. Both men were uncompromising and thoughtful. Ed was one of the most uncompromising atheists yet on your show. That made for a really great listen, especially with such a thoughtful and articulate apologist as Oz. I wish more had been made of the familiar atheist creed about there's probably no God, so enjoy your life, that was made famous by the bus campaign. Oz touched on the fact that not everyone can sink into a comfy chair in Costa and enjoy a bountiful materialist lifestyle. Francis Spufford, coming back to that, expands on this beautifully in his book Unapologetic. What about the carer struggling with a patient with dementia? What of those for whom the cheerful sign-off, enjoy your life, is an insult? I found Ed to be a haunting protagonist. I can relate to his frustration and not having some undoubtable experience of the Holy Spirit, but I don't think it's necessary for faith, and many others don't either. Ed was, I think, spiritually burnt out by his seeking, convicted of his new worldview, and yet open to debate and truth. Towards the end, he did say, I do pray, and that to me spoke volumes. Thank you, Adam. Appreciate you getting in touch. Thank you for listening today to Unbelievable. Hope you've enjoyed today's programme. Do come again at the same time next week. I'll be giving you an update on how Unbelievable the conference went. But next week on the show, looking forward to meeting Graham Veal. Let me tell you what we're talking about next time. You're unbelievable. Graham Veal is the author of New Atheism, A Survival Guide. Going to be talking about that book, and he's going to be in conversation with an atheist skeptic about the new atheism. So come back again for another show here on Unbelievable, the place where Christians and non-Christians talk every week on Premier Christian Radio. For now, I've been Justin Brierley. Thank you for joining me this week. And I'm back again in a short moment's time for the profile interview. My special guest today, Rick Warren.
Mornings can start feeling the same. Wake up, brush teeth, go to work. But with breakfast from Wendy's, it's like, wake up, brush teeth, baconate with a breakfast baconator. Roll with the sausage breakfast burrito. Buddy it up with a honey buddy. Or get seasoned with seasoned potatoes. And then go to work. Sorry. When you're ready for a fresh wake-up call, gotta be Wendy's.
At participating U.S. Wendy's during breakfast hours.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Labor Day sale and get 35% off paints and stains August 22nd through September 4th. With prices starting at $31.84, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.